So you run a syndicate now, is that correct?
Well, syndicate's a funny word, but yeah, we mostly bet on basketball
We're a bunch of
ourselves.
guys who bet together.
We're a bunch of guys who bet together, exactly.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. Learn more about Optimove by requesting a demo at optimove.com/businessofbetting. And if you like what you see, you will get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. I'm Jason Trost, the host of the Business of Betting podcast. Today is episode 205. Special guest, Antonino De Rosso.
You almost got it. Nino
Antonino De Rosso. Very special guest, trader, sports betting insider. He's been on two podcasts that I found very fascinating. One with which was Be Better Best. Did I say that right? Be Better Best.
Be Better Betters.
Be Better Betters, and the other one was the Circles Off podcast. So we're going to spend more time getting into the technicalities of sports betting and trading and less about his bio. But if you want to go into those episodes, both of those were fantastic. So that said, why don't we kick off with a short introduction? What's your background and what brought you into sports betting?
To be short, I like math, I like games, and I don't like sports. No, I'm kidding. But I like sports a little bit too. But yeah, sports betting is very fascinating. You know, if you like games like poker and chess, sports betting is very similar.
So you're a Magic guy, right? That's one of the big things I got from the other podcast. So I'm very competitive. I used to be really into games, and I got really into chess, which I think, you know, most people are familiar with. But I never made the jump to, there's Magic, and then there's, what's the other one? Dungeons and Dragons as another popular game. Like, what did I miss? And I think we're about the same age. I'm 43. I think
42.
You're about 40. You're 42. So we're the same generation. What did I miss about Magic and Dungeons and Dragons that you got?
Yeah, Dungeons and Dragons I never played. But Magic, what's cool about Magic that's a little different than chess, even though they have a lot of similar aspects, is that chess, usually the best player always wins. And a lot of the games are somewhat scripted in chess. You might like to always do a specific start or based on what they like. There's a lot of patterns that you kind of already recognize. And, you know, the games could feel similar from game to game, if that makes sense.
So what was your hook to get into Magic? Did you have a buddy that said, check this out?
So Magic is cool because it's a card game. So there's lots of cards to choose from. And then they should come up at random in your hand. So every game feels different. But the way I learned this, we just started playing in middle school. There was kids that were buying these cards, and at lunch break, we would just play.
And do you still play, or did you kind of grow out of the game?
I play sometimes on my iPad just for fun. But yeah, with two little kids and many, many sport betting endeavors, it's not, you know, something that I keep up with. The problem with Magic itself is that every 3 months, a new expansion comes out. So hundreds of new cards get, you know, published to the public. And you have to spend a lot of time to keep up.
I didn't know that. And did you get hyper competitive about any other games, or was Magic the only one?
I don't know if you ever heard of World of Warcraft as a popular video game, but I used to play the trading card version of it. They also had big tournaments everywhere around the world. And I played poker in the Money Maker boom. I really liked to play Sid and Ghost back then, but those basically the only games I ever played.
I got really into Warcraft 2, which is more of like a real-time strategy game, where World of Warcraft, I forget what you call it, but it's the one where you wander endlessly on the map.
Wander endlessly on the map, correct.
I mean, that's what it is, right? And collect mana.
Yeah, I mean, they make it seem like your character is improving every day, but it never gets to the best. It always needs to keep improving.
And so you never got into the video game aspect. You just got into the trading card aspect.
Trading card game was very similar to Magic. So it was a natural thing to do.
Ah, fascinating. Well, I was starting to get back into competitive chess, but then I found myself ignoring my wife and my kids on chess. So I kind of stopped playing chess. You know, the boom after, what is it, the Queen's Gambit, you know, everybody started playing chess again. So I like everybody, I got chess.com, whatever that app is, and started playing it too much, getting my ass kicked by, I'm sure, like a 10-year-old, and the competitive side of me just thinking, well I'm going to keep playing.
At our age, these games we get worse at, you know, like we're not as quick on our feet that we once were.
The one thing I do keep playing every day is Sudoku. And what I find really interesting is my speed of Sudoku is directly correlated to my mental sharpness. So I usually play at the end of the day. Sometimes I play in hard, it takes me 30 minutes. And sometimes when I'm feeling sharp, I can do it in 8 minutes. But it's a really interesting test to see what the state of your brain is.
Yeah, that's cool.
So you don't like sports, or you didn't used to like sports.
Yeah, there's a belief that knowing sports is actually bad for sports betting.
We actually have that in common. I'm actually not. I follow my university team just for fun, but generally speaking, I'm not that much into sports either. I think partially because I do it for a living, and you know, you just sort of all the games just start to blend together after a while. But I'm not that much into sports either. So, how did you get involved with Pinnacle?
One day, Pinnacle decided to start hiring the best Magic players. And they invited me over in mid of 2008. They asked me if I wanted to go, you know, work there. So I took the leap of faith and I haven't looked back since. But yeah, that's kind of, I can tell you the backstory if you want to know, but they can listen in the other podcast.
Yeah, it was basically about, they were looking for the top Magic players, which I find such an interesting strategy that I never would have thought about. I had Paris on, I would say, I don't know, 10 or 15 episodes ago. And one of the big things I was trying to debate with her was that you have the sort of the exchanges on one side and you have the sort of the low vig sports books on the other side. And I've been doing this about 15 years. I think you've been in this 20 years, something like that, 25 years?
Since 08, so...
The same as 16, me then.
16 years.
Right. So... I think in both cases, you know, the low big model hasn't done as well as I would have thought. I think on the exchange side, it hasn't done as well. And even the Pinnacle Sportsbook, you know, Pinnacle, without a doubt, has been an incredibly influential sportsbook over the years. But I would argue that based, you know, according to what I think intellectually you would think its promise is, I think it's vastly underperformed what you think a Pinnacle model should be capable of. So why don't we start there? Like, what do you think of that statement? Do you think it's a disappointment that the Pinnacles, and then we can get to the exchanges, but the Pinnacle model hasn't been that successful?
Yeah, I mean, the main issue, I think the reason why it's not successful is because to the naked eye, to normal people, they don't actually realize that there's value betting there. So all the casual don't really care about price for whatever reason. And Pinnacle, most of their customers is very sharp. And also, by using that type of model, your margins are very, very small, and maybe you can't spend money to advertise, you know, on a soccer team, or maybe you can't spend money to make your website look as pretty as Bet365. So yeah, it definitely underperformed. I definitely don't understand why when people go to the grocery store, they care about which tuna can to buy, so they buy the cheaper one. But when it comes to sports betting, nobody really cares about the price.
My theory is that humans, well, I don't know if this is my theory, something that I think I probably read somewhere, but humans are really bad at probability. Like, we naturally evolved to build fire. We know how to run after animals, and we know if we're about to die, you kind of get that intuition of like death is around the corner. But humans, because, you know, if you think about humans in the savannah and surviving, you didn't have to be very finely tuned to probability. You know, you needed to know if it was a one or a zero, but you didn't need to know the difference between 20-30%. So, you know, the example I like to think about is that if I say there's a 30% chance it's going to rain tomorrow or a 20% chance it's going to rain tomorrow, most humans would think that that's more or less the same thing. But in sports betting, that's the difference between making a shitload of money and being broke very quickly. So
sports bettors win at 3-4%. So,
yeah, exactly. And I don't think the human brain, like, leaving sports betting aside, I don't think the human brain clocks on to like what 3% chance means. What do you think about that?
I kind of agree. And there's also another reason that I think Pinnacle itself, maybe just specific to Pinnacle, that model didn't work. It's because when they do get square money, let's call it, or recreational money, Pinnacle being sharp is the customers themselves lose their money faster as well, even though they have better pricing, but their lines are much better. I think that might have something to do with why these models aren't working. But I do agree that the human brain does not compute probabilities all that often, you know. Not to make this a down podcast, but, you know, it's, I have a family member who has cancer. There's a 30% chance it comes back, 70% chance it's gone forever. And everybody's celebrating the 70% chance. And I'm terrified because 30% seems so real to me. You know, so it's kind of like the opposite, right? It's people don't understand probability all that much. You're right. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. That must be tough to deal with. The issue with the 30% chance is, I think it's interesting. I know in the other podcast you were talking about the Hillary Clinton Trump bet, and both Trump and Brexit were about 20% chances. You know, one of the reasons I got into this industry is I like the idea of prediction markets, basically betting markets on future events. And everybody said the betting markets fucked this up, they got it wrong, blah, blah, blah. But nobody understands that 20% things happen one out of five times. Yeah. You know, like to your point about the cancer, unfortunately, or any time somebody's saying that, people don't realize that 30% chances happen 3 out of 10 times.
Yeah.
The other thing I will say, I'm getting really into Peter Attia and health, and I don't know if you've come across him on YouTube. He's kind of everywhere on YouTube. He's this health guy who talks about longevity. And one of the really interesting things is he's a doctor, but he took a detour from being a doctor and he was a management consultant for a while. And I think it taught him sort of numbers and figures in a way that most doctors don't get that training. Most doctors are sort of memorizing the sort of procedures and symptoms and things like this, but he sort of sees things in terms of risk parameters. Like, not only do you have the risk that you will get a heart attack, but you also have the risk of doing nothing. And doctors don't often think about that. So the other problem in the cancer diagnosis is that doctors also do not have a very tight grasp on statistics, that even though they're wearing a white lab coat, we tend to give them a lot of authority for wearing a white lab coat, but doctors are not very well trained in statistics, which is the other flip side of that 30% conversation.
I want to say something real fast about Trump and Hillary.
Yeah, go for it.
There might be a reason that Sportsbook did screw it up a bit, because I was in those trading floors, and the problem is, I don't know if it's a problem, but most trading floors that I've been around were very anti-Trump. So, you know, if you're surrounded by no one that you know that would vote Trump, you actually can't think that he can actually win. You know, if we're on social media and I'm a liberal, I'm not. I'm just in general. If I was a liberal, and I would be surrounded by liberals. And
it's okay to be liberal. You don't have to hide.
But yeah, so I think a lot of us do that. Most traders I've met are very liberal and not conservative. So
I hear you on that, but I don't think that's why it was priced that way. I think it was the right price. I know you were talking about this on the Circle Off podcast. But the thing I wanted to add to that when I was listening to it is a few things. One, Hillary Clinton won by 4 million votes, right? Yep. So like she crushed Donald Trump. It's just because of the quirk of the way the American Electoral College works that he sort of squeaked in. The other thing is he won by, like, I forget what the margin is, but I want to say 70,000 suburban housewives, you know, like that went one direction for him. So he won by like 70,000 votes. So not only do I think that he like squeaked it out, he squeaked it out and barely beat her because of the quirk of the Electoral College. But I think if you took a step back, like he got roundly defeated by Hillary Clinton, even though she was very unpopular. So I think this 20% chance of him winning was actually the right price. And I think it was a 1 in 5 event that this led the quirk of the Electoral College. It's like, I understand the theory behind the Electoral College, but between him and George W. Bush, it's let the country down a few times, I think. The interesting thing now is that while we're on the political train, I was checking the Trump odds. Now, I think he's definitely over Biden in terms of probability to win. I think it's overcorrecting the other way. I don't think he's got a strong chance to win as the markets are saying. Let me just pull this up. But anyway, like the markets are really coming down hard on Biden right now. So I think people, because of the upset of 2016, might be overcorrecting for this upset.
It was probably one of the biggest losing days any sportsbook had. So maybe they don't want that to happen again.
Yeah. Right now, SmartGets has Trump at 48% chance to be the next president and Joe Biden at 30% chance, which is also interesting that the market thinks that there's a 22% chance that Joe Biden or Trump won't be.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if I agree with that either.
I don't know enough about politics to know, but that does seem like a lot.
What do you want to know? I can teach you.
Let's talk about sports.
We're not into sports. What about exchanges? I didn't hear you mention exchanges in the podcast. What are your thoughts on exchanges?
I love the concept, obviously, this poetic thing where it's peer versus peer. You know, you're paying less for this transaction fee. But my experience when using them is nothing like that. You're actually, it's sharp people versus sharp people, or better versus, you know, market maker. And a lot of times when you get filled at the price you want is the times you're wrong. It's almost like selectively booking. That's why we don't use them personally. It's because, like, you know, we'll put up an amount of money we want to bet at whatever price. And most of the times we don't get filled. And when we do get filled, it's the times, you know, we lose.
It's called a marketplace, isn't it?
Yes.
So are you saying the exchange operator is doing something underhanded, or there's just really shitty flow in the exchange?
No, I just think that the times, basically the market makers in the exchanges are deciding when to eat up your liquidity or not. Where at the sports book, it's at least you go there, you bet, you know, they have no choice, and then you move on. They're not selectively booking the sports book themselves.
Can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. So let's say this happens a lot too when we send, you know, we want to bet something and we send a message to somebody. If we know that they're a bookie and I say, I would like to bet this team at price X. Mm-hmm. Now, they say, sorry, can't take that bet. Sorry, I can't take the bet. Yes, I'll take that bet for $100,000, right? The times that he's taking that bet is because he has some information that I don't have. He's selectively taking my bet. The exchange kind of works the same way. So, of course, if I see $1,000 or $2,000 on Betfair and I gobble it up, that's just like betting at a sports book. And we do that. But leaving the price up there, you know, 90% of the times, it's not going to be taken. And when it does gets taken, it's because whoever's taking it has more information that I had when I posted that price. Does that make sense?
Okay. So if I put it into different terminology, the average selection on Betfair Exchange is very high, and there's not enough retail order flow to compensate for the average selection.
Correct.
Basically, it's too illiquid, is what you're saying, to be interesting.
Yeah, and when it is liquid, it is from basically other smart people posting their money. So it's kind of like, I prefer to bet a sports book who is just has a line, they can take bets on both sides, than an exchange who only has money on one side sometimes.
So you run a syndicate now, is that correct?
Well, syndicate's a funny word, but yeah, we mostly bet on basketball ourselves.
We're a bunch of guys who bet together.
We're a bunch of guys who bet together, exactly.
Where are you based right now? Florida?
I'm in Florida. Illegal to sports bet in Florida.
Yeah. Well, so every time you bet, you get on a plane and leave the state is what you're saying.
No, it's mostly bet overseas. But yeah, we're a group of guys who we bet mostly on basketball. And then what we do is along the years, we found other people who also have troubles like us betting a lot of money, or they have trouble finding partners to work with. So we made partnerships with other groups. So, you know, they'll bet our basketball, we will bet their soccer or their tennis. And we basically bet for ourselves and we also move for other people.
I assume that you would have a network of runners, I guess you would. I imagine we're mixing British and American terminology here because I kind of grew up in the British betting world. But do you have runners?
Currently, we have runners in Brazil, in England, and in Italy. That go to shops and bet, whatever else. Then we have people who hustle for us and they open up the various DraftKings and FanDuels and whatever accounts they can open up in regulated states. And then
this is what I would call gnoming. They're gnomers.
I don't know what a gnomer is, but yeah, we send them the bet, they bet it for us, and then they give us some percent to us and they keep certain percent for themselves.
Okay.
And then, as any sports betting syndicate would tell you, we bet a lot in Asia, you know, via weird chats like Telegram or Signal or whatever else. And you have to do this because most sports books, once you start winning, they just kick you out. There's only a couple in the whole world that keep you there.
Or you know who doesn't kick you out?
Exchanges.
Exchanges.
That is true.
Interesting. We've come full circle. Well, thanks very much, everybody.
But
okay.
Yeah, the main issue with exchanges is just really I feel there's a lot of selection, like you said, and like just like a marketplace, there's a lot of selection and it's hard. You know, a lot of times when you do get filled, you don't get the best of it. That's all.
So, I mean, I want to say thank you very much for sharing all this stuff, because I know quite a few betting syndicates, but they don't want to come on the podcast and talk about this because they, you know, it's not because they do illegal things per se. It's because they just don't want more attention, which gives them more competition, because most betting syndicates have an edge that's not that mathematically complex. It might be more of an operational edge, which is sort of what you're hinting at. And the more people that do it, the edge goes away and it's less profitable for everybody. So it's really cool of you to kind of pull the curtain back on your operations. Jumping into that a little bit, and if it's too sensitive, I understand. But jumping into that, how do you manage the money and all that? Do you have like a spreadsheet with 80,000 entries in this thing?
We have a Telegram bot that basically every time somebody gives you something, it just gets logged into a Google Doc. We have lots of employees. I have about 12 employees and they work in our group. And on Mondays, they spend all day checking figures. We have a bot that we use to bet offshore. I don't know if you know the world, PPHs and Buckeye. Well, there's
what does PPH stand for?
Pay per head. So in America,
sounds like a steak restaurant.
So in America, I don't know if people know, there's a network of many, 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 many thousands and thousands of illegal bookmakers. Okay. And they all use the same services that come from, I think, Costa Rica or maybe somewhere else, where they pay a service to this company to use their betting book, their skin, basically. And then they give out their skins to people.
So I always called this the agent system. Is this the same thing or is this something different?
It's different. Usually an agent is what it does when an agent brings money, brings a customer to a sports book. Usually what happens, the sports book is taking the risk and then the sports book is paying the agent. Paperhead is a little bit different. The barbershop, who's the bookie, gives this Paperhead skin to his customer. He's booking the person illegally because in America, you can't book. You can make bets, but you can't book. So he's booking the barbershop, the patron, and then he's only paying the sports book in Costa Rica where he gets his skin from, an amount, a flat fee per customer.
So this is sort of like, I never did this, but these, like if people were bookies in college, they would get one of these white label things.
Correct.
And, right. It's the same kind of idea.
Yeah. And there's thousands and thousands and people bring them to us and then we put them in a bot and our bot can bet hundreds of them at the same time. And it's all small bets, $200, $300, whatever, because the bookie himself chooses the limits. So the bot bets them all, and then our bot does the accounting at the end of the week.
And you can have a bot because it's all the same software. So it's correct. Like account 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 all uses the same thing.
Correct.
Got it. And I assume it doesn't have an API that makes this easy. You had to do some kind of kind of things.
As you can see, me not be able to turn a microphone, I know very little about technology, but we pay a programmer that does all of that.
Got it. Be nice to the programmers, okay? Like, we don't stand up for ourselves very much.
We're very, very nice.
Interesting. Okay, so where's your edge come from? Do you have your own model that says 55%, the market's trading at whatever, 50%, let's go all in kind of thing?
Yeah, so basically what we originate is basically we have a model that takes into account many inputs of a basketball game. We bet mostly live. So the model has, you know, what the score of the game is, what the pregame odds were, who has the ball, how much time there's left, and then it spits out what the true odds should be. Whenever there's enough gap between what we think and the market thinks, we go and bet the market.
And you follow like something around Kelly criterion in terms of size and all that stuff?
We kind of, but it's mostly, we do mostly flat betting and not Kelly.
What does flat mean?
It's just always the same amount. And we try to bet things that we think have a 4% edge. But every single sports bettor that wins will tell you that whatever my perceived edge is always less than I actually will win. So, you know, in the last 6 or 7 years, we won at 2%, but we only bet things that we think will have 4% edge.
And again, if it's too sensitive, don't worry about it. What kickbacks do you give for people to run for you?
Oh, okay, perfect. So we usually pay people in two different ways. One, the people who like to assume risk and they believe we win, they can take up to 50% of the amount they bet. We think that's fair. So somebody bets, they bet $1,000, they keep 500 and they give me 500. If somebody does not want to risk money, we can also do a free roll deal where they have zero risk and then we'll give them 20% of our winnings at the end of 6 months, a year, whenever. Of course, if we lose, then we have to make that losses up before we actually start giving them a profit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, interesting.
There's a third way that some runners we have, we just pay them 1% on volume.
And I presume you don't give a shit where you're getting the money down, right?
Well, we don't care. We tell them there's a couple of places that they cannot bet. For instance, for our tennis, we don't want people betting Pinnacle or Betfair. For our soccer, we don't want people to bet HGA or Sing. I'm not sure if you're aware of these places, or ISN. So it depends what sport it is, but they all have instructions on what to bet or not. Not that they always follow them, you know, but yeah, they have instructions.
And when you, God, this sounds operationally complex. Like, how do you know if they got a fill and they lied to you and they and all that kind of stuff?
Trust. And the main issue, like one of our biggest pain point is that sometimes we say, okay, bet you like decimal odds or American odds, for example.
Me? I'm a decimal odds guy.
Okay. So let's say I tell them, okay, I bet this team at 1.9 and they see the Pinnacle is at 1.95. But if they bet that Pinnacle price at 1.95, they will ruin the price for everybody else.
Yeah.
And the times that we don't, you know, we struggle is when people are being too greedy. So if Antonino says, please bet 1.9 as much as you can, but bet Pinnacle has 1.95, people can't help themselves. They will bet it. That is the tough part because people are too greedy. Sometimes, you know, we struggle a bit.
Got it. And do you use tools like Molybet to get into Asia or do you go direct?
We go direct mostly because Molybet charges extra.
Right. So I guess you sort of hinted at a reason to not use the exchanges there because it kind of gives your price away, which you didn't say before. So maybe that's another reason why you don't use exchanges. But like, let's say you're trying to get as much down as you can. Why wouldn't you send this order out to your network and just let the limit order sit in the order book? And if you get filled, you get filled.
Yeah, we do that sometimes. We used to do this with Betfair before they made it harder for us. I don't know when it happened, what year it happened. But before, it was much easier to get into Betfair, even if you were in England or whatever.
Like
but
if you're in Florida, betting from Florida, yeah.
Well, you know that Betfair, I don't know if you know this, Betfair has like illegal skin. I don't know if you know this, but.
I know that. Yeah, I mean, I know the India thing. I don't know if they do much outside of India.
Not long ago, we got a website that was like a thing that looked like they were selling fish. And then you would go and click on it. Like it was like, I don't know, whatever, a red snapper store that sold fish. And then you click on it and it becomes Betfair.
Interesting.
Yeah, they have weird stuff like that.
One of the funny, interesting stories I heard, this is sort of like early sports betting, which predates me being in the industry. But there was something about where you needed to be able to run a sports bet through the credit card system. And they had there's a 4-digit code that says what you're buying. And people used to buy bull sperm. They used to code it as bull sperm. Have you heard this story?
No.
So, you know, because nobody buys $4,000 of t-shirts, right? Like, what are you going to buy this $4,000 every once in a while that kind of looks like a sports bet? And it turns out if you buy bull sperm for your cows, it's about 4,000 bucks a pop. And you do it every 3 months or something. And so all these sports books, US facing sports books, were coding their deposits as that.
That's funny.
This industry we're in, huh?
It's crazy. One of the things you said, it must be really hard to be able to do it all. Really, the hard part is collecting the money because a lot of times, you know, you're on trust and, you know, we have bet that all the time. The tough part, like a lot of websites, a lot of things you have to use proxy services to be able to log in through them. They keep changing the proxy, you know, the proxy stuff. So like you have to battle with that. There's just the betting is almost, I'm not saying trivial because winning is hard, but winning is one of the easiest things when it comes to everything else. Like, it's harder to get money down. It's harder to actually get paid. It's harder to, you know, like you said, keep track of who owes you what. All that stuff is way harder than actually, oh, I have a winning wager.
Believe you might call it breakage. And that's why your 4% goes to 2%.
Probably.
As I was listening to your other podcasts, what I like about your perspective is you're not a sports bettor per se. You know, you're a game player, and which is sort of how I view sports betting more. And so I found that quite refreshing. But one of the things that I was thinking about when I was listening, which I'd be curious to get your thoughts on, it feels to me like sports betting feels so old-fashioned, so backwards, so run idiotically. You know, the technology in this space is, to your point, you were kind of saying that betting is the easy part. You know, it's the sort of all the hoops you have to jump through and all this kinds of stuff. Do you, like, what do you hope for the industry? Like, do you want it to stay, do you think it's going to stay the same way and it's just going to, we're just going to keep grinding along? Do you think like a Google of sports betting is going to come along and hoover it all up? What do you think?
I'm hoping that the sports betting industry becomes better, not for me per se, but for the consumer, because currently the products that they offer are basically crap. And, you know, I just obviously being an American, I would hope that every sports book would take a fair bet from everybody. And being a professional sports bettor is one of those things that, like, you're good at your job, but you can't actually do it. It's the only profession probably in America that's like this. And that's my hope. Because I think there is enough money out there to make sports betting entertaining and enjoyable for everybody. Imagine being DraftKings or FanDuel. How do you kick people out? You get so many bets. You know, you're probably doing a disservice to yourself by kicking people out. You know, if you actually have sharp customers betting and knowing who they are, instead of a new customer with a girl's name who you have no idea if they're good or not, like, they could use that information to make even more money and offer a better product to all. But that's not what they're doing.
Well, I would push back a little bit. And like, I think they're sort of becoming profitable now. I think it's like, if you look at the Star and the adjusted EBITDA, they're profitable. But I don't think they make money. And so, like, even with kicking winners off and having a blended 11% margin, I don't think they still aren't making money.
But
so I think that...
Is that because of, like, all the other... I guess I don't know enough about the state fees and the taxes and all that other stuff. But, you know, it's funny that they ban a person from betting $27 on an NFL game. That's just crazy, right?
Yeah. So what do you think? You said fair. Can you define fair? At least try to define it mathematically?
Sure. Well, mathematically, I'm not sure. But I think a couple of grand on major market stuff, you want to ban people from all the props and all the other nonsense that they offer just because they have to offer it, you know, that's totally fine. But the big, you know, English Premier and NFL and NBA, you know, a few grand, I think it's a fair number to give somebody.
Like for even if you're a systemic winner such as yourself.
Yeah.
And then you and all your friends and then you ramp it up.
But isn't the issue that they don't have an auto mover is also one of the issues? A lot of these websites don't like to have an auto mover.
I heard that term. What is an auto mover?
Okay, an auto mover is when you take a bet, automatically the line moves.
Okay, so like dynamic trading, I guess.
Yeah, FanDuel gets into trouble because a lot of times LeBron James is ruled out and they take 100 bets or whatever amount of bets they get.
Yeah.
If you had an auto mover, at least every single bet would be at a worse price.
Well, I mean, I think you probably know from being on the inside of, from your seat, that these entities are not very good at trading sports.
I agree.
So I don't think that's any surprise. But to me, these companies are built as marketing companies, and they're basically brands, and they're selling a brand. They're not selling trading, and they're not selling dollars and cents. They're selling a brand. And to their credit, they can be quite strong at it, but I do think they're bad at the math and they're bad at the trading side.
The technology as well, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's crazy that they can't differentiate like how much to give a customer in, you know, on props versus an NFL market or whatever it is.
Yeah. I hear you on the sort of like, I'm kind of torn on the, do they have the ethical right to ban winners or not? On one hand, I think it's like you're a trading entity and you're basically, by banning winners, you're saying you're not very good at trading. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, I think any business has the right to decide which customers they want, which they don't, as long as it's not a protected class. for example, you know, they're not obligated to get railroaded. Because if they did take, let's say they took 3,000 pounds on $3,000 in every game, you would syndicate that thing up and send 5,000 people after them, and they would get hammered.
Yeah, I'm not one of those professional bettors who says, I can't believe they banned me. Like, that's totally, you know, if that's, you're right. If they don't want my business, they don't have to take it. I kind of hate how they do the opposite, though, that when you are a loser, they're raising people's limits. You know, sometimes we get a FanDuel account from somebody who's been losing, can bet $100,000 on anything, right? So not only are you banning the few people that could win or the people that can win, but you're also saying to every loser, you're like, hey, please lose more. That kind of sucks.
Think about a business that doesn't operate like that.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I mean, every time I go to the mall and walk by the Louis Vuitton store or something, there's always like 30 people waiting to buy a $5,000 purse, you know?
Yeah. You're right.
I get torn on the, in terms of like the $100,000 and all that kind of stuff. Like, again, it's a dichotomy of like, what kind of world do you want to live in? On one hand, people get over their skis. There's no question that sports betting can become addictive and the dopamine centers in your brain gets hijacked and you're unable to kind of control your impulses, just like me when I'm eating dessert, for example.
Me too.
On one hand. And yeah, we should be mindful of these people. On the other hand, people are adults. You know, if you're over 18, you got your own money. You should be able to make your own decisions with your own money and let people make their own bad decisions. And people make bad decisions every day and buy stuff that they shouldn't afford all the time. So I get quite torn on both sides of this issue.
Yeah, I knew I'd like to. Like, you're actually almost changing my mind, which is very refreshing.
There's two sides to every argument. I really appreciate this talk. Like I said, it's really nice to have a professional bettor come on and be so open. And for those of you that are not familiar with professional betting, this has been an incredibly open conversation that I've had behind closed doors. People say this stuff when it's sort of off the record, but people very rarely say this on the record. And I think one of the purposes of this podcast is to pull the curtain back on the industry because there's no need for it to be overly complex or opaque. And, you know, let's make sports betting better. And conversations like this do a lot to kind of push to make sports betting better. So I really appreciate all the openness that you brought today.
I'm a big fan of your show. I always listen to it. Believe me, I do listen to it all the time. I actually was listening to it as well before when the other fellow was doing it, Jake. I forget his
name.
And
Jake Williams.
I always wondered, like, you guys are doing, you know, business of betting, and it's always an operator trying to sell us on a dream instead of the people actually doing a lot of betting. I'm happy when Jesse asked me to join, I not say no, because I always wondered why you guys never had any bettors, you know?
Because they all say no, all the syndicates, and you know who you are that listen to this podcast, you all say no, please come on the bet. If you have other professional bettors that want to come on, I'm very happy to. I'd love to talk more about this.
Okay, great.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. It was a great conversation.
All right, have a wonderful day. Thanks a lot, guys.
Cheers.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. Learn more about Optimove by requesting a demo at optimove.com/businessofbetting. And if you like what you see, you will get your first month free.